Our last speaker before lunch is Kelly Bowden. She is a perinatal outreach nurse educator at Maine Medical Center and has had a number of projects over the last years that's really done a lot of focusing on education for nursing and physician staffs, specifically around the period of purple crying and educating the families about these. And then also around safe sleep with newborns, and has also helped develop the was a co-leader for the development of the Snuggle Me project here that was really looking at establishing guidelines to assist providers that are caring for drug affected mothers and also their newborn babies. And she's going to talk to us today about a new project that she's involved with, a collaborative, and specifically looking at a new tool that we use, are starting to implement at Maine Medical Center for substance-exposed infants that she's going to go into a little bit more about, that's replacing the Finnegan scoring.
So I realize I'm standing between you and lunch, and that's always a challenge. I also want to commend Jeff, because Jeff was the only one that followed the directions from Dee, which was try not to use a PowerPoint for these quick hits. So great job. So let's see. Am I advancing with this? So I want to talk first, how many of you take care of newborns, have delivery room responsibilities? Only a few. So for the rest of you, check your email, go to the bathroom, but come back in about 10 minutes because you're going to want to hear what we're doing around substance-affected infants. I want to talk, this is just a little visual of the work that's been going on for basically the past 10 years in the state. And you think 10 years, like, how did this happen? Why did it take so long? I think back to the first talk of the morning about collaboration and building relationships and time to play. My predecessor, before she quit, she said, you know, when we have to talk about yoga and toothbrushing, I'm leaving, and she did. And here we are today talking about yoga and toothbrushing. So this is just a visual of the process that's occurred, and I'm going to give you a little bit of detail and still try and stay within our time frame. So about 10 years ago, when Dr. Sheila Panette was the director of the Maine CDC, there'd been a number of, she'd received a number of phone calls around what was happening with home birth and some really poor outcomes based on planned home births. And around that same time, we were fortunate, Steve Meister was our leader of the Child Death and Serious Injury Review Panel, and they got together and said, okay, so like, how can we really figure out what's going on? We've heard these anecdotal reports, but what's really happening? What's the data? And so Steve really undertook a very intensive process, asking hospitals to voluntarily send in these reports. It wasn't a real scientific study, but it gave us enough data to put some focus to this work group at the CDC. It was also coincided with a period of time where the state was updating their birth certificate to the electronic format that I think torments some of you, and others of you really like it. But really, some of the things that Steve recognized and the panel recognized was we had something like a 400% refusal rate for newborn blood spot screening in those families who were choosing home birth. So why? So that was a piece of the work. We recognized that handoffs were non-existent. There was really no consistency. And so that really started some of this work moving. We developed a transport communication tool. A group that I facilitate of nurse managers from around the state agreed to invite home birth midwives to come to our quarterly meetings. And we really got this interprofessional group up and running. Gordon Smith was part of that. think, I don't know, Gordon, we're some of the members that have stuck with this for the entire 10 years. We had the successes with the Continuum of Care Collaborative. The midwives in 2008 had tried to become licensed, and that was a failed attempt. Gordon was kind enough to get some grant funding from the American Medical Association, and we had facilitated discussion sessions with the home birth midwives. It was also the ACOG, A1, which is the Association of Women's Health, Obstetric and Neonatal Nurses, the Nurse Midwifery Organization. I think Steve and some of the others had input into the group as well. And the home birth midwives achieved successful passage of the licensing bill in 2015, Gordon.
A couple years ago.
It was an unfunded bill, and so last year we got funding for it. And as of January 1st, 2020, anyone doing a home birth will be licensed in the state of Maine. And there is an exclusion. There are a couple religious communities, Quaker and Amish communities, where that's their tradition is sort of you learn from each other to be able to do home births. So those are excluded. Other than that, in order to do a home birth, you must be licensed. So that was a really huge success. And then we said, well, okay, this group's now been meeting for 8 years. Like, what do? We formed this relationship. And so we said, well, now that we have the relationships, we should keep going because we've had some successes. And thinking about a perinatal quality collaborative, we're one of the few states that doesn't have one. And really having the diversity of stakeholders, and I think about the diversity that's here today, and sort of trying to replicate that in a formalized fashion. They really are networks of perinatal care professionals. It includes public health, any members of the public, any members of industry who are really committed to improving pregnancy outcomes for women and newborns. So really focusing on evidence-based practices, interprofessional collaboration, and really that birth is occurring within a cultural and social context. So our group is called PQC for me, and really, again, focusing on the overall state of perinatal health in Maine. We started looking for a home for the PQC, and it seemed natural to approach Quality Counts. And I remember Amy when she was a resident, and so that was an easy conversation to have. We've been working collaboratively over the past several years on a variety of topics. And certainly Quality Counts is really focused on transforming health and healthcare in Maine through their efforts to around leadership and collaboration, aligning improvement efforts. I'm going to skip over this, just again, focusing on the evidence-based practice, interprofessional education, you know, the potential for doing case reviews, because what keeps us up at night, you know, that resuscitation you did, the baby that you gave antibiotics to, that maybe the baby didn't need them, or the baby that you didn't give antibiotics to and they really did need them. So an opportunity to discuss those things in a constructive fashion. What worked? What didn't work? What would you do differently next time? Is there recent evidence or professional organization standards? These are really pregnancy-focused topics, but just to give you some examples of what's happening in other states, New York State working to reduce preterm birth. California has an amazing quality collaborative. They're really focusing on reducing cesarean sections and using data and really focusing on what works. So we really need sort of everybody that's involved in caring for pregnant women and their newborns. And that can include things that we don't necessarily always think about. So faculty from colleges and universities, liability insurers, and payers, insurance companies. So everybody really benefits, and really we want you to be thinking about joining us on this journey. We have a really nice, our next door neighbors are all over this. Some of you have already heard about NEPQIN. It's the Northern New England Perinatal Quality Improvement Network. It's consisting of New Hampshire and Vermont. We have CMMC, Maine Med, Midcoast, York, and Waldo. Hospitals are all currently members. Southern Maine Medical Center is hot on the trail of joining in the near future. And so they have access to conferences. They have the ability to submit data, so they can be looking at outcomes, which is really an important piece of this. So this slide is actually from Dr. Bonnie Whalen, who's a pediatrician at Dartmouth. And I want to just spend the last few minutes talking about this Eat, Sleep, Console methodology for assessing newborns. So if you're in the hospital setting and you know Finnegan's scoring tool, 21 items that takes a lot of nursing time. It's aggravating to families. It's probably aggravating to the pediatrician who's trying to figure out what's really happening. And so Dartmouth, using work that started at Yale, they're working with Yale and Boston Medical Center, and really focused on more of a function-based assessment. And I'm gonna show you some pieces of the tool in just a second. But really, their goal, overall goal, is to improve the health of newborns. And let's not give medications to newborns who are experiencing withdrawal symptoms unless they really need it. We want to decrease the length of stay. The healthiest place for a baby is not in the hospital. It's really home with the family. So simplifying the assessment tool makes everybody happy. You hear from families all the time with that Finnegan tool, and this nurse does it this way, and this nurse does it a different way, and we hate it. And then, of course, as part of this triple aim of keeping people healthy, having better care experience, we also reduce costs. So the tool, the top part of the tool looks like this. You'll see the first item is eating. Does the baby have poor eating because of neonatal abstinence syndrome? It's a yes or no. There's no one, two, three. Is the baby sleeping less than an hour because of NAS? Yes or no. Are you able to console the baby within 10 minutes? Yes or no. And then it starts to get a little bit into how much effort does it take to console the baby. A little bit of effort, moderate amount of support, or the baby just doesn't soothe within 10 minutes or requires a lot of intervention and support. And then another important piece of this is focusing on the mom, right? Keeping moms and babies together. And this work has actually, in some ways, been part of the most challenging because in working with our obstetric colleagues, they've got to be giving moms the heads up. Like, it's not you're in the hospital for 24 hours or 48 hours. We really want moms staying in the hospital with their baby as long as the baby needs to be in the hospital. I was talking to a group of nurses, and I said, okay, how many of you, if your three-year-old went into the hospital, how many of you would just drop the baby, the three-year-old off and then go home? And they looked at me like, well, no, of course they wouldn't do that. So why do we do that with newborns? So the bottom part of the tool is starts with management decision. If you answer yes to any of those first three questions, you can call a huddle. And the huddle is basically just a little briefing. It can be just with the parents or caregivers, or it can be with the medical provider. You know, if the baby's not eating, he's not gaining weight, really inconsolable, maybe it's time to start medication on the baby, giving the baby a single dose of morphine. In the past, we've done Q3-hour dosing of morphine, and for those of you who have cared for these babies, over the course of the baby's usual two-week stay, how many doses of morphine do you think that a baby would get? Somewhere around 80 to 100 doses of morphine. So we're giving these babies a ton of morphine, and maybe they don't need it. So that's another big change that's associated with this tool. And then really focusing on the non-pharmacologic interventions and trying to standardize those so that every baby has the same pieces that the families are trying to implement. And you'll see there's a safety component here, safe sleep and fall prevention. This is a newborn care diary that moms or the caregivers fill out. It's really a guide to help guide the discussion when looking at the Eat Sleep Console tool. It helps keep the family involved. Boston Medical Center has an occupational therapist who's created some nice videos, again, trying to standardize the non-pharmacologic treatment. Undertaking this work has not been simple or happening quickly. At MaineMed, it's been a clinical transformation project with leadership from the top, putting resources into it. We've had a clinical pathway work group, a data work group, the Eat, Sleep, Console work group, and Chris Modell and others have been on that. The EPIC work group, trying to get the electronic medical documentation pieces built. Prenatal education, Leah Fox, has been instrumental in helping us get materials ready to be giving to pregnant moms. So this is just another piece of the journey. For years, we've cared for these babies, and I think now we're starting to really get some evidence about what is going to work best for them and their families. We are working on some more educational opportunities. I think you'll hear more about this at the AAP Fall Conference at Point Lookout. And Amy and I are working on doing something intensive at MaineMed also at the end of October. So stay tuned. Any questions? You have my contact information. Be happy to talk more detail. Yeah, thank you. Ryan.
Once infants do start pharmacological therapy, are you using the same scoring system, the ESC?
Yes.
To
yes, so Ryan's question is, are we reverting back to using Finnegan if we have to start drug therapy? And so the cool thing about the drug therapy now is it's a single dose. And then you use Eat, Sleep, Console assessment in 3 to 4 hours to reevaluate how the baby's doing, talk about whether the baby needs more medication. It's not automatic Q3-hour morphine dosing anymore. It's really morphine PRN.
So suppose it's 10 o'clock at night. You have a very irritable baby who's really very symptomatic, and your physician is at home, mm-hmm. and you're scoring every 3 hours, and every 3 hours this baby needs treatment. So you're gonna wake me up every 3 hours for the next, like, week. I'm just gonna,
yeah.
I take care of these kids afterwards.
Right.
You know, at 2 months of age, so.
Yeah.
So that's, I'm just looking at what the downside would be.
Right. So that hasn't been the experience at Dartmouth, Yale, and Boston Medical Center, that the PRN dosing has truly been PRN, that the babies don't need Q3-hour dosing. It's enough to kind of get them over the hump. The other thing is, if by encouraging the families to be present, they're going to learn while they're in the hospital. I think there's been this misperception on the part of families that, oh, the NAS is done and we're going home now, so everything will be fine. And they haven't realized that, no, NAS symptoms can continue, Loretta Finnegan says, 6 to 9 months. And that's when you get the phone calls.
Well, and I've seen these kids, you know, in my office.
Yeah.
When they're 3, 4 months old and in foster care, the foster parents are saying, well, this is the colicky kid I've ever had.
Yeah. So, John. Yeah. Right. So, right. So we talked a lot at Dartmouth about that. And so the nicotine and the SSRIs you're really going to see in the first 24 to 48 hours. And the bulk of the NAS symptoms are going to start around 72 hours. So, but good point.
And a lot of the nicotine, I mean, you might see the irritability and not sleeping that well, but they usually eat fairly well. They don't have so much the disordinated stuff, and so a lot of times they're looking.
That's a good point. And Sue has been on our work team too. Sorry, Sue, forgot you.
I was just saying, a lot of they're fussy and they don't sleep well and they can do withdrawal, but usually they eat pretty well, and that's a big thing you're looking at, like weight loss, weight gain, how well they're actually kind of feeding and stuff like that. So it kind of helps separate it out a little bit, not entirely, but.
Right. The other thing I was going to add to Kelly's comments about the acne. The other thing that kind of before implementing this, patients were being kind of set on a standard dose, and then depending on severity of their score, depending on you might be going up on that dose, and then possibly you can need adjunct therapies added onto it. And then at the time, once you kind of get them stabilized, you're only weaning them like once a day, about 10% of their dose. This is actually going to have, if we have a patient who's on a higher amount of morphine, they might be weaned up to 3 times during the day in terms of their dosing. So our hope is also that they're going to need less medication and also be kind of off morphine treatment even sooner. The data that this is coming from is pretty impressive in terms of the amount of kids, like the length of stay, the decrease. I mean, like on average, we have a cohort that we have this data for Maine Med. I mean, we were averaging about 20 days, but the average length of stay was like 18 to 20 days. The cost for treatment for treated patients is extremely high. So our hope is we can really impact these families and decreasing their length of stay, their treatment rates. And also, I mean, this is something that's only you're gonna see more of, because as if you look at the data for Maine specifically, right now it's about 8 to 10% of all births are drug exposed babies. So, and that's only crept up every single year.
So Kelly, I wanna bring you back to the home birth part, because the two things that we found in when we did the child death review was that the infant mortality rate in the home births was 10 times higher than much higher risk births in the hospital. And we found that so many of the babies that were getting into trouble were really high risk deliveries that were being at home and they weren't being screened properly. And so I think one of the agreements was for a change in the training, because for a home birth, for a so-called professional midwife, that you needed 6 months or less of training. You had to be at 25 deliveries, not necessarily do 25 deliveries. I did 25 deliveries in 6 weeks as a medical student. And I was not prepared to be a home birth midwife. So I just learned to be I wanted to take care of that baby. And could you just comment about the training and what's required? It's different, because it really is a different thing.
Yeah, that was really the game changer from the perspective of the obstetric professional organization, ACOG. Once they realized there was going to be a standard formal education, and so we do have a formal school in Maine in Bridgeton, birthwise, where it's 18 months of didactic. And then I think it still is that they have to do 20 deliveries. A piece of the licensing, though, to your point, is going to be around risk factor analysis, assessment, and then a true informed consent, because one of the other pieces of your study was that there was no standardization with respect to informed consent. So some families were told, don't worry about VBACs, the hospital overestimates the complications from VBACs, and then other women had true informed consent about the risks of having a VBAC at home. So it is another piece of the licensure, and we really could not have done it without the work that you did to lay the foundation. So thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Great.